Hey, friend. Welcome to Houston Made, a show where I, Rusty Gates, get to talk with local Houston-based entrepreneurs and business owners about what it's like to be in the middle of that journey and selfishly gain insights as I build my own business. In this episode, I got to sit down with my very good friend, Jeff Gilmer, who's one of the five co-owners of the very successful company, Pretty Cool. They make and sell beautifully designed and carefully crafted home goods that are both functional and truly stylish. Pretty Cool has been sold in stores like Nordstrom, West Elm, and Anthropologie. They've been featured in everything from Better Homes and Gardens to Architectural Digest, and you can find their products in unbelievably cool spots like the Ace Hotel. Long before I got into real estate, and even longer before this podcast, Jeff was sharing their adventures in entrepreneurship with me, which honestly played a big role in pushing me down this path. On top of all of that, Jeff is an accomplished photographer in his own right and still owns and operates a successful photography business. Before jumping in, I just want to say that I've really enjoyed hearing how much this show has inspired some of you in your own entrepreneurial journeys. It's incredibly encouraging and validates so much of the work that goes into the show. Now listen in as Jeff and I discuss how Pretty Cool brought together so many creatives from various backgrounds, the importance of vacations in the face of hustle culture, and the importance of quality control in relationship to brand identity. Jeff Gilmer of Pretty Cool and Jeff Gilmer Photography, thank you so much for being here and being a part of all of this. I'm going to let you share a little bit about Pretty Cool and all of that in just a second, but I want to say some nice things. I've known you for a good while now. How long have we known each other? When did you?
2015.
2015 when you started.
Yeah.
Okay. So 6 years.
Yeah.
That's like some time.
Yeah.
And in that time, you've been really generous with your journey and kind of information about your photography business, about Pretty Cool and this business that you've built and been a part of. And so much of that was such an encouragement to me along my own journey that I really don't think that when I jumped into real estate that I would have had the courage to like be a business owner had it not been for your willingness to share kind of the behind the scenes look. So thank you for all of that. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Pretty Cool? I know you have a photography business. We'll talk about that too. But tell us about Pretty Cool, what it is and how you fit into all of that.
Yeah. So Pretty Cool is a home goods brand I co-founded and co-run. Originally there were seven of us when we founded the business in 2017. There are now five of us, five partners. And we make cool things for the home, primarily in concrete is our main medium, but we do some stuff in wood. We make incense. We've tried different things, but most of our business is around concrete. We get to work with awesome big companies like Nordstrom and West Elm and Anthropologie and stuff like that. We've gotten to partner with awesome hotels like the Ace and the Line Hotel. And so all kinds of one-off boutiques all around the country. You know, I sent an order to New Zealand the other day.
No big deal.
Europe. So it's crazy. It's been 4 years now, and every year we've just grown and grown and expanded and continued to try and do what we can.
Yeah, that's really cool. Okay, so I mean, we're in your shop, your studio, here down in Houston. And you guys, all around us, there are incense holders, coasters, there are drop boxes, I see some clocks, there's a little bit of everything, soap dishes.
Yeah.
And it is, it's concrete and it's cool colors and unique shapes, things that really catch the eye and are very, I would say, modern. Is that how you would describe kind of the style? What's the aesthetic here?
Yeah, I mean, it's clean and modern, but we definitely have like a 80s, 90s flair to it. Very much inspired. We're all between like 33 and 44-ish. That age bracket's like 80s, 90s was like our childhood and growing up. So it's like bright colors, you know, kind of fun shapes, things like that. But definitely modern and functional. Like everything we do, we try and have it with like high design function as well. So it's not just a pretty aesthetic thing. It like actually is designed with a purpose. And most of the things we, you know, make have a specific purpose, whether it's to like hold a toothbrush or incense or a coaster or a clock or something. It's not just a pretty thing to put, like an ornamental thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's so cool. I have one of the coasters on my desk. I have one of the coasters downstairs. Basically any place in my house that I sit, I have one of the coasters that is my coaster that I use, and everybody else gets to use it. The incense all smell amazing. So, you know, on your website, you've got your mission statement, or an explanation of what you are, and it says pretty cool. Was founded by a group of creatives who wanted an excuse to collaborate on well-made, fun, and beautifully designed products for the home. How did that happen? How did y'all come together and then come up with this idea?
So originally when we started kicking around the idea, there was probably, let's say, 15 or so people in the mix that, you know, we were just like, let's get together, let's throw ideas around, see if anything sticks. And then people start to weed themselves out at the beginning for whatever reason.
Sure.
And I was one of the people that I wasn't an afterthought, but I kind of got dragged along with Catherine, my wife, who is an awesome designer and has had her own business before this. And they're all hanging out and it's other people I know. And I'm like, well, I want to come too. I want to hang out.
Yeah.
So when it got down to the last seven of us, it was back and forth on whether or not I was going to like jump in.
Like in other people's minds or in your mind?
In my mind and in other people's minds. I mean, I'm, you know, working a 9-to-5 and running a photography business on the side. So I didn't have a whole lot of bandwidth anyways.
Yeah.
But I'm one of those people that just like loves to be involved in things and like to be around people and don't want to get left out and FOMO'd and all that. And it was something that was like outside of my background. Mm-hmm. Like I am not a designer. And so getting to be a part of a company like that was intriguing to me. And, you know, so I had some skills that would be useful that weren't actually hands-on designing. So I hopped on and, we whittled down to this group of seven. And kind of everybody had their own backgrounds, which is one of the ways we've been able to grow so quickly is like people have different resources, whether it's, you know, financial or skills or connections, know people, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So we had somebody that could do ceramics and we have Mike that can do concrete and Catherine can do like clothes and has that background. And so we just started to like throw around ideas for products, started out with a few. Mike, who does all of our concrete products, he had his own business beforehand. And so some of the products we pulled on were from his original collection.
Yeah.
But we jumped off from there, did different colors, and that's kind of how it started.
So most everybody, aside from yourself, was making something.
Mm-hmm.
Or they had backgrounds, right? I know. So you had an artist. What are kind of like the if you were to classify all the different roles that people had or jobs, that feels like a bad word.
Right.
What were those different like people?
So you had somebody who worked with concrete, whose background was actually in like architecture. We had a ceramicist. We had, two people that worked more like textiles. One of them, Catherine, my wife, being more like clothing textiles focused. Mm-hmm. She worked for a corporate, clothing manufacturer and company and designed for them before moving to Houston. And, one of our other textile person is more like jewelry focused. And, you know, MFA and teaches at the collegiate level.
That's crazy.
And then we had one that, he did ceramics and like art, fine art in college, but then went the route of doing photography and videography and is awesome at like creating content.
Yeah.
And, one of us who is an attorney by day, but a painter and just like paints and has his own thing where he like takes commissions and paints. And
stuff. How did that, you talk about the 15 people that came together to begin with. How did you all find each other? What is the centralizing thing? Again, it sounds like you have all of these people from drastically different backgrounds, different jobs and industries, but also different hobbies and passions and side gigs, whatever you want to call those. How did you meet and how did that 14 come together?
Yeah. So I met Catherine on a dating site.
Nice.
And that's how we got connected.
Perfect. And one went to two.
Yeah. And so Catherine went to RISD as well as Mike. So they met up at an alumni event years ago, like let's say 2014 or something, 13.
And what's RISD for people who may not know?
Rhode Island School of Design. So it's one of the best design schools. If you meet Catherine or Mike, you will hear that they went there probably pretty quickly. It's one of those things that people take pride in, and it's for good reason. Yeah. It's, they don't just let people in. Like, it's a very intense program, and a lot of really amazing designers and honestly, like, famous people have gone to school there. They both went to school with like celebrities and things.
That's crazy.
So it's a really cool school. And so they met at an alumni event and started collaborating, wanting to do some things together.
Yeah.
Catherine was doing a menswear accessory line at the time, so like ties and pocket squares and things. And she decided to do like, oh, I'll sell some soap dishes, and because I'm going to do soap. So Mike did a soap dish for her.
Yeah.
And then Carrie, one of our partners that does textiles, she was hand dyeing some of the ties that Catherine was doing. So like, Catherine would get the fabric, take it to Carrie. Carrie would hand dye it. Then Catherine would take it back and get it manufactured into a tie. So that's how they met.
So a lot of it was, it was just natural,
like
meeting,
working then, relationships. Yeah. You know, it's a fairly tight knit community in Houston. There's centralized places, whether at the time it was like pop-up shows were really at their peak, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, like everywhere there was multiple pop-ups going on at the same time.
Yeah.
And then just meeting through friends of friends, like-minded communities and things like that. Yeah. Yeah.
I, you know, I say at the top of the show in every intro that this show really is based in some selfish interests of mine to selfishly gain insights as I build my own business. And that's one way of putting it. I think the other part is like, so that I can talk to people that I want to talk to. So I get the excuse of, or I get justifying something with an excuse. Even the tagline that y'all say is, you want an excuse to collaborate mm-hmm. on these things.
Yeah.
And then this is an excuse to talk to people that I want to talk to about things that I want to talk about. But what do you think it is about this generation? Again, you guys are firmly millennials in a lot of it. Loosely millennials, very much 90s kids in mm-hmm. some way.
Yeah.
What do you think it is about this generation that feels its need to justify its place in the marketplace?
Oh God, like millennials?
Yeah, yeah. I think that, right, I feel like it's like, well, I have to have an excuse to talk to these people and have this show. You mm. guys need an excuse to work together and mm-hmm. to do this kind of stuff. And I do see, it seems to me that there is this kind of thing in this generation, which if we're recognizing that generations mm-hmm. can be kind of fluid, that feels like we have to kind of stake our claim and justify our existence there. Mm-hmm. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I think part of it could be growing up that, you know, of course we're told you can do anything you want, like everybody is.
Yeah.
But with the caveat that they don't tell you, like, as long as you make enough money mm. and you can do anything you want if you make enough money to support yourself, your family, and provide a good life. And so I think for us that reach for things that might not be the most lucrative careers, whether it's something in the arts or something creative, or something that, you know, we do as a passion, that's not always, like, we feel like we have to have an excuse to do that. And that's why so many people have side hustles. And sometimes it's just straight up to make more money because they want to make more money.
Yeah.
But some people, it's like they want to have that creative outlet. They want to have control of something because, you know, we were growing up. Yeah. Do whatever you want to do as long as you make enough money. So be a doctor, be an engineer, be a, you know, lawyer, whatever. Even if you don't like that, because it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And I struggle with that too. Like, I don't think that people necessarily need a job that fulfills them. Like, I don't think you should get all your fulfillment from any one thing, obviously.
Sure.
But I don't think there's anything wrong with clocking in, clocking out, 9 to 5, making enough money to have the life you want outside of work.
Yeah.
The problem that we know nowadays is there are very few clock in, clock out jobs.
Yeah.
Everything is 24/7. You are on call. It doesn't matter if you're an exec assistant or, you know, a designer, a marketer, whatever it is, we're all expected to be on 24/7 if you're at a corporate job.
Yeah.
And so I think more and more people just want control of their lives. And they will say, I will drive Uber 70 hours a week if I get to decide, well, I'm going to do it during these hours, or I'm going to, you know, work for a couple hours, then take a nap and then go work a few more. Like, people just want control. And I think that nobody was given that freedom to do that. And so we all have to have that excuse, like just the excuse part of it.
That is a hot take. I think that's,
I'm here for hot takes. I'm
That's what it is. Dropping bombs. I mean, there's so much there to unpack that I think is really interesting. I think this idea, yes, we've been told, yeah, you can do whatever you want, be whatever you want. And that's not true. I mean, first off, no, I can't. I'm not playing in the NFL. That's not happening. Yeah. I cannot do that. I honestly think regardless of the amount of training that I put into mm-hmm. it, it wouldn't happen. But who knows? There, I guess an argument could be made otherwise.
Yeah.
But yeah, the idea of, sure, but you need to make money. Mm-hmm. You have to pay bills and the financial responsibilities of life. And I mean, yeah, the student loan debts we carry. I have student loan debts that unless something happens with this government that I'll be paying those off for the rest of my life. That's mm-hmm. just how that's going to go. And it was this idea that if I do this and I get this, it'll set me on the path. This is the thing to do. And mm-hmm. then you use that path then to pay off those student loans.
Right.
I think ideally in a short amount of time was a pitch that I was sold, but it just didn't play out that way. And we see that across to the point where I have my two sons and I would really love it if they didn't go to college. I don't want them to just get a liberal arts education to get a liberal arts education. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, there's that whole line in Good Will Hunting. If you could have gotten this for $1.50 in late fees, this whole education for $1.50 in late fees at the local library. And I feel like so much of that is true.
Yeah.
All of that is really interesting. And I think there is something to be said. This podcast, I'll just say, I recognize that this probably glorifies the entrepreneurial spirit by definition of this podcast. That's what we're talking about. So it definitely glorifies that.
Yeah.
And that's the target audience. That's who I want to talk to about this stuff. But certainly we need people to make this society run that work for big organizations, mm-hmm. work for medium organizations that just clock in, clock out. And that idea that those jobs are actually becoming more and more all-encompassing because of the rise of technology, mm-hmm. because you can, it seems like the double-edged sword of the remote working kind of spaces. Yeah, right. You can work from home when you want to work, but you need to work all the time.
Right. Yeah, for sure. And to be fair, like, I need people to help me. Like, I can't do everything. My partners can't do everything. And so I need people that can do stuff. But we try and have some level of flexibility with the people mm-hmm. That work for us. You know, we're not huge. We don't have any full-time employees at this point, really. We just have mm-hmm. people that help us out part-time. And with that, there's a lot of flexibility. Come and go as you want, as long as you do what you need to do.
Hit our deadlines.
Yeah. If we can get our orders out when they need to get out, then I'm fine for now. And obviously, as you get bigger, you do need more structures. We need that. But I don't ever want to be a place where people are on 24/7. We just don't want that. And that's what we're trying to create, it is a place that we would want to work.
Yeah.
If we were the lowest level employee in the company, which I am right now, basically, because I do everything. I have people that help me, but ultimately everything falls on us. If things are going to get out, you know, and somebody can't help that day, then I'm doing whatever that job is.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's driving a package over to FedEx or like picking up boxes, meeting somebody, whatever. But we want it to be a place that any of us would want to work.
Yeah.
Yeah. If we were just coming in 10 years down the road, we're bigger and we would want to be coming in because it's a cool place to work.
Yeah. That's a good segue to the structure of the company, because this is one of the things that I remember when you first told me this. It's not an overly convoluted structure, and yet it blew my mind to be like, wait, that's amazing. So talk about the structure on the terms of how the partners create things, when those products are made, what the relationship is with Pretty Cool, and how that all works to the extent that you can.
Sure. So there are currently five of us, five equal partners. And basically one of the ways we've been able to grow without a big capital investment from us individually or taking outside money is basically it's on the individuals that make the things to front the costs. And then as it sells, Pretty Cool makes a profit, a slice, and then that person that made it gets a slice. And so Mike, who makes our concrete products, that's, 90% of our business. And he's been able to grow and scale his. But basically, he's fronting all the costs for everything. We're at a point where it is a constant flow of orders. There is a queue of how dozens of wholesale orders at any given time. We're doing, you know, 100 orders or whatever a week directly to people. And so he's always going to have this constant cash flow now. But at the beginning, like if whoever Anthropology was like, we want 100 of this thing and it's, you know, $10,000 worth of product, he's going to have to front that until they pay us, which it might make him 2 months to make those. And then it might be net 60 terms. So we don't get paid until 60 days after it's shipped. So he might have to front that for 4 months before he gets his money back and then his profit. Mm. But it's enabled us to grow without having to plunk a whole bunch of money into like buy things up front. It's not a structure that we think is going to work forever. It works really well right now. It does add a lot of levels of back-end work for like Catherine and for our bookkeeping. But it's worked really well for now.
Yeah. Keeping track of all that. So
it's insane.
Yeah.
It's insane.
The logistics of it alone are fascinating. And then each person is owning their piece and then kind of selling it to the company. Mm-hmm. But really waiting, like
it's almost like consignment is the best way to do it. Like we're just not buying the products outright and then selling them when we do. It's, you know, we're selling products and sometimes it's made to order. Like he's not going to make 100 of something unless he knows we're going to sell it. And, you know, we have a lead time, say it's a month or 2 months. So he knows he will get paid or I will get paid for whatever I'm making. But at the beginning, it was definitely like making things in the very early stages to sell it like a pop-up show. Mm. So I'm going to make all these things, go do a pop-up show, see what sells, and then I'll get the money.
I still get so excited about it. I just think it's the coolest structure in the world. And I'm sure it's not without its tension, right? Sure. I mean, obviously, y'all have had some partners leave for reasons that we don't have to get into. But I imagine that some of it is like y'all have to have a pretty damn good relationship.
There's a lot of trust for sure.
Work through all of that and the back and forth. I mean, what does communication look like? You'll have team meetings. How does that all play out?
So before COVID, we met every week. We met once a week and we moved into this space. I think it was August of 18. And so we would do our meetings here and we were packing up our orders for the week. And like there was, you know, so few orders that all of us collectively could pack them all in a week and not have to come in every day. Whereas like now every single day, myself and one or two other people are in here like packing up orders and getting stuff out. But back then we would meet every week and then we would do like full on meetings like once a month where we're not working meetings, but it's more like we're going to have beers. We're just going to like spitball things, have fun. We always talked about doing a podcast for the company that we never did. It was going to be called Three Beers Deep.
Okay.
Because that's when the ideas really started getting weird after a few beers.
That's fantastic.
But never got around to it. Yeah. Too many other things to do.
Sure.
So now during COVID, we tried to meet once a quarter. Either we would go outside in distance or we would do it virtually on Zoom. But now we're at a point that like Mike and Catherine and I talk on a daily basis. Mm. And then our other two partners, Carrie also has a studio here. So I see her in the halls a lot and we talk, you know, a couple times a week. Eric, I see a lot because he's a close friend.
Yeah.
We don't really do a lot of big team meetings. We did a once a year retreat that we would do, which we didn't get to do in 2020. And now it's halfway through 21 and we still have, or no, I take that back. We did do it in 20 because we did it in January.
Yeah.
So it's been a year and a half since we've done one of those and they've been fun. We've done overnights and a good chance to just like bond and come up with ideas, big picture stuff.
Does it feel like a business? I mean, obviously there's a lot of work to do. So there's work, but I think about you and I also have worked together, as you said, that I think you're the third guest that has been a part of the company that we all worked at. And we worked together. that to me, it felt like a company. And I mean, maybe that's because it had walls and there was a handbook and a dress code. And maybe that's why to me, it feels like quote unquote a company. But it's still, when you talk about all that, it still feels like five friends hanging out. Does it feel like a business, or is it just when shit hits the fan, like, oh, now it's a business?
Both. Yeah, it just depends. There's times where it definitely feels like a business and times that it doesn't. I think because we don't have a lot of employees, we don't have people working for us. So I think that kind of makes it feel like it's not a business. But from the outside, people definitely assume we're way bigger than we are.
Yeah.
Just because the people we've worked with, the scale, the amount of things we sell. Like, I was looking yesterday and, you know, there's a margin of error based on our system, but individual products, year to date, we've sent out about 16,000 products.
Holy cow.
Like individual things.
Yeah.
You know, that might have been a couple thousand to a big box place, or it could have been like one thing to somebody's house. But I was just like shocked at that number.
Crazy.
And telling Mike, like, how many things do you think we've sold this year? I don't know, 3,000, 4,000. I was like, no, dude, you've made like 10,000 things at least. So it's pretty crazy that a few people can pull that off by themselves. So I think once we start to have more people, once we're all in the same space, it's a little disjointed right now. So that's part of it not feeling like a company as much sometimes.
Yeah.
Because like I have my studio at our house. I'm making incense there. Mike's doing all his production. He's in the Woodlands, has his studio. He has a couple people that help him.
Yeah.
And then he's bringing it all down here to our studio here at Sabine. That's like our central hub. And that's where we're shipping out orders, boxing things, packaging things. And then we got a second space here that's really just like overflow storage, staging area for larger orders where we just need to like be able to put a bunch of stuff in a place.
Yeah.
So I think once our next step, our next phase, once we get into a much larger space, ideally we're going to have production in-house in the same space that we're doing like fulfillment, and that'll just cut down that and it'll tie people closer together. It'll feel a little bit more of a business. But we also, because of the nature of how I said, we want to kind of be able to work our own schedules and things like that, that kind of is different. So like Mike gets up at like 6 something in the morning and he works all day, but then he's like cashed at like 5 PM. Whereas I come in at like 11 or 12, but I'll stay here till 7, 8, just however I'm feeling. And you know, go home, edit, do stuff at home, or like, I like my mornings at home, or like, I want to go to the gym or something.
Yeah.
So we would be on very different schedules if we worked in the same place, but it doesn't really matter either because we're not collaborating that closely on things.
Yeah. Is there any kind of redundancy built in of if something happened to Mike?
No, absolutely not. We talk about this all the time. Like, we need a life insurance policy on several of us. Cause if any one of us died unexpectedly, their things would not run smoothly.
Yeah.
And that's sad because of the background that you and I had working together. Like, we know how important that kind of stuff is and succession plans and things like that. So it's definitely on the list, and we need to figure that out quickly.
Yeah.
But there's just so many things you have to do when you run a business.
Yeah.
So many things.
Well, and you talk about the next phase, but is there a world in which you don't, I mean, I guess a part of the question is there a limit on how big you want to get, or are everybody's goals slightly different? Or because obviously I think some people think, this is what I experienced when I got into real estate, was that everyone, and I joined when I started, I was with Keller Williams, and all of the training that they did, everybody that they, the way that they talked to all of the incoming realtors was, here's how you become a mega agent. Here's how you become $1 million real estate agent, where you're making $1 million a year and you're not even like working in the business anymore. Like, you have built this team underneath you. And I remember reading all of that. I don't want to do that, but I have no desire whatsoever to do that because there's so much work, and the type of work that you have to do, I don't want to do that. So is there a limit on how big you want to get, or is it no, like, let's get this as big as we can and we'll just try to keep the spirit alive along the way?
It would depend who you ask within the company. But I think all of us are really at the point that we want to get it as big as it can get, with the caveat that we maintain quality and do everything as much as possible in-house. And that's been a big thing for us. Like, we literally make every single thing that we sell is all produced in-house. And that's a big thing when you're selling 15,000 things in 6 months. Like, Mike hand makes the molds that he casts his concrete into and hand casts it himself, or he has a couple people helping now. But start to finish, like, he's putting the cork on, we're branding it with an iron. Everything we do is here. And so we can, like, weed out quality or imperfections and things like that. So he's doing it on the front end. It's coming to us here. And, you know, I'm boxing up things, or somebody's boxing up things, and they're like, hey, look at this. What do you think of this? Is this good or not? So, like, we have hands on where we can actually, like, weed things out as we need to. And I think as long as we're able to do that, we don't see any reason we can't just continue to get larger, just more people doing those things.
Yeah.
I mean, the goal is absolutely to at least get to a place where we're not hands-on doing the things that we're all doing right now. Mm-hmm. And we can focus more on growing and bigger picture things and doing the things that we're skilled at.
Yeah.
Which at the beginning you just can't do.
Yeah. You have to do it all.
Yeah, you do. And, like, one of the best pieces of business advice I got was, like, you have your three buckets. You have, like, $10 task, $100 task, $1,000 tasks. And at the beginning, you're doing all of it. And you want to, like, offload those $10 tasks first. Like, the things that somebody can do, building boxes here, or for Mike, it's, like, people that can just clean molds, or at a restaurant, it's the person that's washing dishes. It's, like, the things that take time, but you need to find people that can do them for you. Then you have, like, your $100 tasks, things that you do, but you could probably find somebody that could do them and do them well, but you're going to have to pay a lot of money for that person.
Sure.
And then you have your $1,000 tasks, which are the things that are, like, uniquely you, things that you bring to the table that are, like, integral. And, like, the more that you can do those tasks, the better it is for the business. And that's what we're trying to do, is, like, get to a place that I can do more things like photo shoots and more content and, like, posting more to Instagram and that side of things. And Mike can do more designing, because he's our main designer, but he is, like, in the weeds of making things 24/7. Like, he works 7 days a week. I mean, we all work 7 days a week because we want to.
Yeah.
And it's, like, what we like. But getting to a point where he can just straight up be designing and not
playing with things, making mistakes, trying this, like, it didn't work. And you can't,
if you take a day off, if he wants a day off, like, people just don't take vacation. We're good at taking vacations. That's a skill that we've gotten. Like, Catherine and I need time off. Like, it's because we work so hard that we need time to, like, unwind.
Yeah.
And so I feel like everybody needs that. And, it's hard to grind it out for years now, just 7 days a week. So hopefully we get to a bigger place where we can start to free up some time for all of us.
Yeah. The travel and vacation thing is a really interesting piece. I have a rant that I enjoy going on, which is essentially saying that I hate vacations. and the main point of the argument is that I like my life, to your point, you know, working 7 days a week.
Yeah.
You do it because that's what you want to be doing.
Right.
And I have built a life that I enjoy. I like my house. I like my studio/office that I've made for myself. I like sitting at it. I feel comfortable. I designed it for me.
Right.
Anywhere I go will not have a studio designed for me. Mm-hmm. That's just inevitably it. And yet, I also just think that it's part of it is that, you know, I've got two young kids.
That's
we don't have a ton of money. So, you know, vacation, we're just not good at it. I think that's it. It seems like you and Catherine really are good at traveling and good at vacations. What is it about you guys that makes you good at vacations?
Not having kids definitely helps at this point. And I think part of that is, we know we don't have kids right now. We may not, who knows in the future, but, like, we want to enjoy this time together. And, you know, we didn't get married as young as a lot of people do. So, you know, we just had our 5-year anniversary. But, you know, it was 30 when we got married, and I guess 31, 32, something like that.
Somewhere
around. The math was not lining up once I started to do, five.
How old am I?
We want to, like, maximize that time together. And we love our house. We live in a tiny little bungalow, but, like, I cannot afford to build the house that I would like to have. Mm. So I think that that's part of it. It's like escaping to places that are like, oh, this would be a dream. Like whether it's an Airbnb or like a hotel, that's like the aesthetic that you're into. It's being in a space that's inspiring for one. Traveling's so great for everything, for like mental resets, inspiration, grounding. It helps you have like a goal or something to look forward to. So I think it's a good thing. People need to take vacations. We know that Americans don't. Yeah. Like people don't take their vacation time even that they're given. Yeah. And this is in a country that does not guarantee that for anyone.
Like, sure.
The only developed country in the world basically that doesn't guarantee vacation time for people.
Yeah.
And now you're seeing companies that are like essentially mandating it, like all mainly in like the tech sector and things like that. But like the whole company is shutting down for a week because we know that a lot of you just will not take time off unless we make you.
Yeah.
And like, you're still getting paid. Don't worry. But like, you need a reset, which is so sad that that's our culture here.
Yeah.
It's like go, go, go. And yeah, we are glorifying entrepreneurship and working 7 days a week,
yeah, but it's culture, not all of it.
Yeah. It is not a great thing inherently.
Yeah.
Like good can come of it. And I think that that's all what we're hoping for. You and I, like, we're grinding it out because we want a better future.
Yeah.
And hopefully that future for you, it's freedom.
Yes.
And to not have to grind.
Yes.
And like, if you want to keep grinding because that's what gets you active and motivated and like excited, then that's great. But it shouldn't be grinding to pay your mortgage
or sure.
grinding to pay your student loans. Like,
yeah.
That's not what hustle culture should be about.
Yeah.
That's or the grinding dark, for the new side. iPhone.
Yeah.
The, or whatever.
The negative connotations yeah. of it all. Absolutely. I think one of the biggest misnomers out there is that I grind at all. I think that when it comes to the Enneagram, it was Sam Murray, our mutual friend, who called me out. I thought I was a three because I was constantly climbing social ladders anytime mm-hmm. I could. I'd like walk into room and be like, who do I need to know? Oh, that person seems like the person to know.
Yeah.
And I would go introduce myself. And then Sam, who worked with us, was like, Rusty, you've never put more than 70% effort into anything I've ever seen you do here. He's like, you are not a three.
That's amazing.
And that was how probably 6 or 7 years after being introduced to the Enneagram that I realized that I was a seven mm-hmm. because I was like, oh yeah, no, you're right. I don't.
Yeah.
I pursue joy so much of, you know, real estate market's been weird this year. And that's led me to some places of like, well, do I need to go get a desk job? Do mm-hmm. I need to do that? And I was kind of open to it. I really was like, well, you know, it's a yeah. new thing. I won't be there forever. It'll just be for as long as I need it to be. And it'll be new people and a new thing. And that will be exciting to me. And that's enough for me to push through however bad it is. But it was Jess, my wife, who got on to me about it. She's like, absolutely not.
Yeah.
She was like, no, you go find a way to make it work. You go find yeah. another side hustle or whatever, because she appreciates the freedom that I have.
Mm-hmm.
And we found, and I don't know if this is true, but we found that it seems almost necessary in this society that one parent out of the two in two parent homes, like it really works better if somebody has a flexible schedule.
Sure.
And
yeah.
You know, I think that's where that whole like quote unquote stay at home parent mm-hmm. kind of thing comes from is it's like, and a lot of times early on when we were just starting, like when she was pregnant with our first son and all that, we were doing the math on, no, okay, so you make this much money a month and childcare is this mm-hmm, much money. Like, mm-hmm. okay, so could we just come up with the $1,000 difference that we need and to make that work? And,
right.
And she didn't want to stay at home and I didn't want to stay at home. We yeah. love our kids, but
yeah,
even during the summer, it's like, okay, like y'all can go to summer school a couple days a week.
Right.
Like,
right.
It's good for you. But yeah, I think all of that is, it makes things more difficult and, I think the vacation piece of it is really good and refreshing and when it is done really well.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously you guys, as pretty cool, are you've got products in all of these really cool hotels across the country. And I imagine some of that has come from traveling, of building those relationships and even finding those places.
Yeah.
Whenever I travel, I get on Marriott and be like, that's my membership. And I was like, where's a level 4 hotel?
Yeah.
That's my life, but it feels like you guys kind of tapped into a little bit of a cooler culture, if I had to say.
I don't know, man. Like the Ace in particular was one of those ones, like we're having our first retreat or something. We're talking like goals and things like that. That was like a dream client. We're like listing out dream. Who do we want to work with? and like love to work with hotels, like the Ace would be awesome. And the fact that it manifested, I'm not sure how much of that was just like us willing it into existence or the fact that we like their aesthetic. So we kind of designed things in that way that they were when they found our stuff, because they found us, that it just made sense. Which has been every, you know, that's another cool thing about our business is everything's been organic, really. Like we haven't had to hustle really to get anything. We've done trade shows and those are big investments and stuff, but we're not marketing stuff. We're not advertising places. We're not running Google ads and we're not doing stuff. So we've been able to grow fairly organically, which is great and how you want it. But yeah, I don't know how we, how the Ace happens. It's just fortune, I guess.
Yeah, it worked out.
Yeah.
Well, and again, when you guys are talking about and you have so many different people with different connections to be able to just explore opportunities, I think too, one of the really fascinating things that I see, and this goes back to you talked about growing and saying that, you know, you want to grow as long as you can kind of keep the quality as high as you can.
Yeah.
And to me, I think that's a part of what opens doors for you guys. This is just my speculation on your growth now, is that you guys do such a good job of creating not only interesting products, which are designed beautifully and done, but also are just very well made. Because, you know, Bob and I talked about this when he was talking about Statesman, if, that anybody can do what we do. You can buy, I've seen it. I've seen it on Instagram, but people buying concrete and making coasters and all
that. There's like classes advertised on Instagram, like do it at home kind of stuff. Yeah, for sure.
And you can do it and you can go to a pop-up and do whatever. But I think the thing that separates y'all is such high quality. I mean, you can just tell when you pick up one of your coasters or any of the pieces, I'm just like constantly staring at these pieces behind your shoulder, that they are so well made and that y'all really will sacrifice if something with the tiniest imperfection. And I've seen that, and knowing your wife, Catherine, from the very beginning, seeing her at some of our like wine tasting parties, working to remove the tiniest of threads from a tie. Where does that dedication to excellence come from? I mean, is that just all of y'all kind of inherently have that, or?
Man, oh gosh. I don't know. I can't speak for like Catherine or Mike or Carrie or Eric or anything, but I mean, I could speak for me and I could probably speak for Eric, but I'm not going to.
That's fine.
Cause he's such a good friend, but like, I don't feel like I inherently have that. I feel like I'm not a perfectionist, in a good way. You and I were talking about that a little bit on Instagram, talking about Tony's, and, obviously it's very different when you're talking about something like that, like food. Where it is so personal and subjective and things like that. Whereas like a concrete thing, it's hard when you know what the highest quality you can achieve is. And then you get one that has like a slight imperfection. And on its own, I would say this is fine, but I know what it can be. And I have to say, okay, this isn't, this doesn't pass the muster test or whatever. Part of it is like, just designing things that can be the best versions of themselves. And Mike is really good at that and really smart. And the coasters are like the best example of that. It's the most functional thing. And when I use a coaster anywhere else and I pick it up and it lifts with it, it drops to the table and I just get so mad. And I'm just like, it doesn't have to be like, you could get a coaster that works right.
Yeah.
But we think about that stuff like, oh, the surface tension on this is not going to like pick it up when the condensation hits the coaster. And so it's going to stay there. So it's cool to design things well to start with. And a lot of that is not being a straight artist. And it's really like this production meets art thing. Things have to be scalable. Things have to be reproducible. Things have to be teachable. Whereas if it's art, one, you don't necessarily want that. You don't want to teach somebody your secrets. Whereas we're, you know, we don't tell everybody everything that they want to know. Like people constantly message us like, what do you use for this? How are you using this? What do you do? Like we've shown videos of like behind the scenes stuff and just question. And like, we're fine to tell people like, here's sealers. Or go to YouTube. Like you said, like the information is out there. Like there's literally nothing in the world you can't find the information. And I don't know if it's just like a lazy thing or the information that people are finding they don't trust or whatever, and they see our stuff and they're like, oh, this is cool. And we've had tons of our stuff ripped off all the time. Like, you can go on Alibaba and find molds of products that we designed. Like,
wow.
In like, we designed them. These aren't like, some of our things are more generic, like a little catch-all.
Yeah.
Or like a cylinder, like planter thing. That's not, we're not trying to say we designed the cylinder. This is the first ever cylinder in existence. But like our coasters and our soap dish, those are unique designs we came up with. Our trivet specifically. And it happens to everyone. Like, it's just part of doing business. And that's why we have to fall back on the quality aspect. Mm. Like, people can go buy those molds and cast our product, but they're not going to hit the quality that we're doing it at because they don't have the experience. They don't have the knowledge. And so we have to maintain the quality to stand out because at a certain point, like, it is a, it's a premium product.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes people see our stuff and just, that's so expensive. Like, nobody's going to pay $24 for a soap dish. I'm like, well, we sold like 2,000 of them this year so far. So like, people will.
Yeah.
And that used to happen to Catherine all the time with clothes. You know, she'd be at a show and somebody's like, who's going to pay $80 for a tie? She's like, actually a lot of people actually. So
that, a lot of people, I mean,
Look
at some of the shoes that Yeezy has put out.
Yeah. Oh God.
People have paid ridiculous amounts of money. For and things.
When it comes to like that perfection level thing, I think it's because we're all so like connected to the products now too. As we've gotten bigger, the bigger you get, the more complaints you get for one, the more things that get to people that are just damaged. Yeah. Like, it's just part of it. It's not that it was damaged necessarily here, but the more hands something touches, you know, we ship something to somebody's house, UPS could have kicked it down the street or USPS or FedEx or whoever.
The Ace Ventura opening scene.
Exactly. So there's that, but then you get bigger and we ship it to a factory or a distribution center for Nordstrom, and then they're putting it in a box and shipping it somewhere else, and then like the more steps, the more likely it is, and then the people come back to us, and it's not a quality thing, it's just the nature of logistics.
And
there's no reason it should bother me, but it does.
Sure.
And I think it's just because we feel like this is our child in a way, like it's a business and we want to run things like a business, but it is like you have that connection to the products.
Yeah.
And I don't physically make them, but like, I'm connected to it. And somebody is disappointed, you know, that it bumps me out. So I want to make sure what each person gets is like the best version of what this could be.
Yeah.
So that that is least likely to happen. So I think that for me, that's where the, that quality perfection comes in. It's not an inherent thing.
Well, and I mean, you guys really are the brand. Again, it goes back to the needing life insurance policies on all of you, right? That this wouldn't exist without you. Even if you're not a creator, I've known for years that you were a really big part of pulling the creators together and getting things moving in a straight line and connecting some of those dots and making sure that the shipping and the packages and those relationships are the business relationships are handled. And so you, along with all the makers, really are the brand. Like, pretty cool. Wouldn't be the same thing without you. And I do think that as you were talking, it seemed clear to me that that's a part of what a brand does, is it elevates beyond, you know, just you doing a thing. Right. And I say the same thing with even with this show or with real estate, but really with this show of, you know, there's plenty of things that I do in my life. I'm not a perfectionist by any means. I'm happily a good enough guy. Joyfully a good. Yeah, no, I did it. It's just, I'm not great. But much to my wife's chagrin is that she is absolutely a thing should be done the right way, because that's how things ought to be done. And I just feel like, well, let's get it to good enough and move on with our lives, because there's so many more things to do in life. Yet with this show, like, I spend a lot of time editing and producing and curating and coming up with questions and all of that, because I love what I'm building here, and the brand is bigger than me. And it feels like the brand holds me accountable to a bigger thing, that it's not just Rusty and a microphone.
I think that's part of it too. Like, back to Enneagram, me being a 9, it's I'm thinking about Mike or Eric or Carrie or Catherine, like their product, they might not have noticed something. And if I send it out and I know that it's got an imperfection or something, I don't want it to come back to them as the maker.
Yeah.
So I'm like protecting them more so than myself. It's, yeah, it's thinking about them.
A huge thank you to Jeff and to you for listening to this episode of Houston Made. If you enjoyed this conversation, this is actually just the first half of the talk that we got to have. So be sure to listen to our next episode as Jeff and I dive deeper into his own journey and discuss how his photography went from shooting high school yearbook to the world of professional skateboarding to some of the most glamorous weddings you've ever seen. In the meantime, you can find Jeff on Instagram at JeffPhoto and follow the company at pretty.cool. That's PRETTI.cool, where you can check out and buy some of their beautiful products. I legitimately have one of their coasters and concrete cubes within a few feet of me right now, and I personally endorse their incense sticks, specifically the aroma they call Get a Room. So go get some, let me know what you think. If you're interested in connecting further, you can find me on Instagram at Rusty J. Gates or the show at Houston Made Podcast. I'd love to hear about your projects and the endeavors you're working to get off the ground. Houston Made is hosted by me, Rusty Gates, produced and edited in collaboration with Luke Bronner. Our artwork was designed by Stephanie Leal and Sarah Alwegfi in collaboration with Mac Ryan Creative. Credit for our theme music goes to Old Friends, New Friends. Houston Made is glad to be a part of the Milieu Media neighborhood of podcasts and storytellers. We are people who care deeply about human connection, and in our neighborhood, we find that connection by hearing and appreciating one another's stories and by sharing our own. To find more shows made by amazing storytellers from all kinds of backgrounds, visit milieumedia.com.